So these three things, inner thinking, emotional reactions, and guiding principles, are what make up the interior cognition. That interior cognition from way back in the past, like some other experience at some other project at some other job, will have influenced the way that you act in certain situations that come up, will influence your preferences and your opinions about things.
Welcome to Designed to Be Conversation, presented by Designed to Be and hosted by Designed to Be founder and CEO, me, Rachel Weissman. Designed to Be is a community for designers to grow their emotional intelligence. In this show, I have conversations with design leaders about how investing in their EQ has impacted their design career. In today's episode, I speak with Indy Young. Indy is a researcher who coaches, writes, and teaches about inclusive product strategy. Her work is rooted in the problem space, where the focus is on the people, not users. Indy pioneered opportunity maps, mental model diagrams, and thinking styles. Her way of approaching the problem allows teams to truly pay attention to people, without letting cognitive bias and assumptions creep in. Indy has written two books, Practical Empathy and Mental Models. She builds knowledge and community via a series of live online advanced courses about the importance of pushing the boundaries of your perspective. She was one of the founders of Adaptive Path, the pioneering UX agency. You can follow her on Twitter at Indy Young, and access many resources on her website at indyyoung.com, as well as at medium.com/inclusive-software. We dive into what it means to listen deeply when doing research, how to collect knowledge about a purpose rather than a solution, and how to create a safe space so the person you're listening to can access their interior cognition. You'll come away with some fascinating examples and actionable techniques for deep listening. Welcome, Indy, to the show.
How are you doing today? It's been a weird day, like we said, two Tuesday, whatever. We are releasing my third book, which is called Time to Listen, soon. Within a month. And part of the first chapter is on my website. If you want to navigate to indyyoung.com, there's a section called Knowledge. Under that is books, and you can find it there. So you can start reading a little bit early. We're going to actually have a little bit more stuff there in another few weeks. But, you know, things are proceeding a little slowly. I'm self-publishing this time around. So there are some things that need doing that will take a little bit more time, shall we say.
It takes time. We're going to be talking about making time to listen. So a lot of what you'll be sharing in your book. And for folks who do have questions, be sure to populate them in the chat, and we'll be answering them in chronological order within the last 10 to 15 minutes of us meeting. So turning back the clock a bit, I'm curious if there was a point in your career that made you realize the importance of listening.
I don't know that it was an actual point. I think it just happened to be a circumstance where I was a software engineer when software was making the shift from being developed for other engineers and scientists to being developed for regular people. One of the early projects I was in charge of in terms of the interaction design way back when was for reps at a call center. And they, meaning leadership, wanted to just change out all the machines that the reps were using, which were green screen machines that you, I don't know if some of you may not have seen anything like this, but you don't have windows. You only have the tab key to wander around in the screen. And I'm like, you know, I really want to know how people are accomplishing what they're trying to get done. This was a call center to help people who had lost their credit card. This was back when credit cards were only just becoming popular. People would use them when they're traveling internationally, and sometimes they would get lost or stolen, and they would like panic and call this call center and go, help. And the call center would try to fulfill a new card. And the people in the call center, they spoke, I think, you know, 9 different languages. So when you walk in there, it was kind of babble. It was most amazing and very rich. But in addition to that, this was before Google Maps. So at the end of each row of cubicles, there was an atlas, because people were trying to fulfill these, get these replacement cards to people in various towns and cities all over the world. And they were also aware of each other. It's like, I was talking to you at lunch the other day, and you fulfilled something in Bangalore. Where did you send it? What neighborhood was that in? Does this work for my person? And so there was a lot of interaction between people, person to person. And so what I did was I ended up trying to map out an understanding of how people were accomplishing that purpose of getting that card to that person. Part of it had to do with calming people down, or reassuring them, turning off the ability, if the card was stolen, for somebody who stole it to use it, and all of that sort of thing. So this inclination to try to understand those people, I think, just came from the fact that we were not writing software that encoded a process. It was just clearly a human thing in addition to a process. It all lived together, and I needed to understand the whole thing. Not only that, leadership wanted to take away these screens that people were used to using and were very quick at using and replace them with mouse and windows. And I'm like, that's not going to be super efficient. So I kind of want to understand how I might be able to roll something out like that, that will be close to the efficiency of the old way, or we're somehow balance it out. Yeah, I can't say that. I mean, still today, leadership is all like, ooh, shiny new toy, let's roll this out, without really regarding what effect it's going to have on people. So that's where that came from.
Yeah. And so I'm curious, with this realization, how has that impacted, or maybe it was a series of events as well. Because we're talking about this a little bit before we press record and let people in. When people think about communication, the attention very much goes to how you're speaking, how you're storytelling. And yes, that's so, so, so vital. But it's really only looking at half the equation. Yes, these words are coming out of my mouth. And yes, I'm using my hands and I'm moving my body now. But your response of even having this smile and shaking your head, that's also a form of communication. And yes, that's also a form of listening. So how did that realization, maybe it was a series of events as well, impacted you now writing a book on the importance of listening and how folks should make time to listen, especially as designers?
I definitely had a journey with regard to listening. Early on, I'm like, oh, I'm just going to go, you know, figure this out. And of course, figuring this out doesn't mean observing. Observing only gives you your own take on what people are doing. So from the start, I was like, tell me, you know, what's going through your mind here? What were you doing? What are you trying to get done? What's the purpose? How are you approaching it? And so that was always my kind of approach. And in the early days, I would do that and try to not take notes, but write everything down that they said. So try to write a transcript as I was conducting this sort of thing. Mm-hmm. That involved a lot of like keyboard shortcuts in my Word document. But I realized along the way that my attention was not 100% on that person. It was like 50% on the keyboard trying to capture what they were saying. And I'm like, okay, that's not cutting it. I need to just record this thing, whether I'm there in person, whether I'm doing it remotely. And then going forward, realizing that not everybody can do this or is comfortable doing this spoken with Audible, being able to do it via text, being able to do it over the course of many days and communicate at the speed and cadence that that person feels comfortable with. One part of the book is all about making a safe space, making a space where that person feels comfortable with you, trusts you, so that they can actually get down to their interior cognition with you. So one of the things that I explain in the book is that there's a difference between professional interviewing and listening deeply. So when you are a professional interviewer, typically you prepare in advance the questions you're going to ask, the knowledge that you want to capture, and you kind of guide everybody to, you know, down through that maze. And in reverse, the people who are the interviewees, the participants, expect to be guided. This results in knowledge that you curate. It will not result in knowledge that you don't realize you need to know. And what I wanted to do was understand things that I didn't know. I wanted to have that beginner's mind. I wanted to not introduce topics, but introduce instead the purpose. There's one purpose that everybody's trying to address that I'm studying. So with the call center, it was, you know, try to get the card to that panicked person in that city. That was the purpose. A lot of people had different approaches to the purpose. Some people focused on the emotional side of things and helping people emotionally. Others didn't focus on that. And so there are different and equally valid approaches to that purpose. And so if I'm going to hear how somebody fulfills that purpose without influencing it, without putting my own, you know, assumptions and bias even on it, I need them to bring up the topics. I need them to lead me rather than me lead them through the maze. So I don't prepare a list of questions. I prepare, and this takes actually a month or so, with the team that we're like, what knowledge do we need? And let's come up with a purpose that will help us find patterns so that we can then synthesize those patterns. We can let those patterns emerge. Synthesis is very different than analysis and qualitative data. We can let those patterns emerge from the data without our influencing them.
There's so many pieces that you touched on that I'm like, ooh, I want to go on that. Oh, I want to go on that. Taking a step back, one piece that I am so curious about, and you mentioned creating a safe space. Mm-hmm. So I'd love for you to, what are ways that folks can go about, you hinted at so many different techniques and approaches. And yeah. Maybe it is woven into what you are already talking about. Can you provide a bit more color there?
Sure. To begin, each person may have their own way of creating a safe space. There's no one true way of doing it, but it does begin before the listening session starts. I encourage people to do their own recruiting, not to rely especially on market recruiters. Marketing research is very different than this kind of research. Market recruiters have databases of people who have signed up, and those people may not be the people who have done a lot of deep inner thinking about the purpose that you need to hear from. So it begins with us finding people who have done a lot of thinking about it and us very intentionally reaching out to people who we have been ignoring, or perhaps who we know we have been harming or being made to feel unwelcome or not respected for their way of thinking. Think about any old enterprise software that you've had to use in the past year. Like, that is not a delightful experience. And the purpose itself is not meant to delight. You know, you're going to like say, this is where I'm taking the vacation, right? Or which healthcare I'm signing up for, or, you know, this report I need to make. There are so many different, one of the early studies I did was with employees and their approach to their relationship with their employer. So that was the purpose we were exploring. That was a pretty broad purpose. And so we had to include a lot of people in that study. We included maybe 20 to 40 people in that study. Typically, I can narrow a purpose down so that we only need 10 or 15 people to really give us an understanding of what are the different kinds of approaches to that purpose, and also this idea of different thinking styles to the purpose. So this purpose and the way that we craft that purpose up front is really influential on the knowledge that we create. But that recruiting, I think, is a big part of it. We're looking for people who have done a lot of deep thinking about this. And we have an intro session with each one of them before we decide to include them in the study. With a market recruiting, you just get a bunch of names and you call them up and you ask them these questions. And half the time, it's not a really good fit. Most of the time, they're just doing this for money and they're not willing to forge rapport with you. We begin forging rapport, building trust, setting up a relationship so that this deep interior cognition can flow in that intro session, where I sort of lay out, like, who am I? What knowledge am I trying to create? Who all is involved? Mm-hmm. What is it that we're going to ask you? And how is it that you're going to lead us through this? This is your mind that we're trying to understand. Mm-hmm. And we're interested in different perspectives. In the listening session, by the time you get to the listening session, you have such a connection already with this person that when you both get on the phone, it's kind of a warm reconnect. It's like, yeah, I know who you are. You sort of double check that they're like still in the mood for this, because they're going to be leading you through their interior cognition about the purpose that happened in the past as they were addressing it in the past at certain points in time. And so it's important that they're in the right frame of mind for it. Sometimes, you know, weird things have happened during the day. And so my first check is like, you know, is this still the right time to sort of sit down and talk to me about this? Sometimes it's not. Sometimes we reschedule. Sometimes somebody's had, you know, enough time to think about it. And they're like, yeah, you know, I'm not totally comfortable doing this. I'm like, that's fine. We don't have to do it. We will cancel it. It is a different kind of connection because it's much deeper. And I've mentioned this interior cognition, and I'm hoping this is going to be one of your questions coming up.
It does relate. Where I was going next actually was there a time either in a research study that you're leading or building a relationship with a coworker or client. And someone just clearly wasn't listening. and what did you do to help them listen? Or yeah. what can designers do to, maybe they are running a research study or, one of their partners that they're collaborating with just really, it's not really landing.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. I also get the same question. The answer applies when people say, well, how do I persuade somebody to do this? The whole thing goes back to the people that you're working with are not there to be persuaded to your way of thinking. They're not there to manipulate. However, when I find these situations, I do this a lot, actually, where I ask people, give me a typical conversation where it's going, you know, poorly. It doesn't sound like either side is understanding the other and things are tense. And what I do is I break it down. I say, these are the types of things being said. So there are various topics that come up. And maybe the topic is about, I don't know, designing a screen that you had agreed to, and maybe the product manager decided to go off and design it slightly differently and went behind your back and gave it to the devs, the developers. And so there's some tension there, right? The topic is this redesign. And what generally happens is that people will throw at each other opinions. They will throw at each other commands. Don't do that. Don't go behind my back. You agreed that this was what we were going to do. Or, hey, I think I had a better idea. So what they're doing is they're speaking at surface to one another. So this topic is like a jawbreaker candy. One of those spherical candies that has layers to it, right? Each topic that you talk about with your coworkers or with somebody in a research scenario, they're going to bring up a bunch of topics, but each topic has those layers. And there are outer layers and there are interior layers. So the exterior layers contain or are made up of explanation, what happened, what was supposed to happen, how something works, how something was supposed to work, description of that thing, description of what was done, scene setting of the context, like, you know, you were already in bed and in my time zone, I could work on this. And so I did it that way. That's context. That's exterior level. Alongside that is this kind of expression level of my opinions, my preferences and sort of attitudes and behaviors around this topic. Those expressions are actually built on past interior cognition. Interior cognition is actually made up of inner thinking, emotional reactions, and guiding principles, which are the very personal instructions that you have or rules that you have about how you make decisions. They're generally not very broad. It's fairly personal. So these three things, inner thinking, emotional reactions, and guiding principles are what make up the interior cognition. Mm-hmm. That interior cognition from way back in the past, like some other experience at some other project at some other job, will have influenced the way that you act in certain situations that come up, will influence your preferences and your opinions about things. And then you express those exterior things to your coworkers, and your coworkers don't understand. We don't understand the roots of it. And without understanding the roots of it, we're just throwing these things back and forth and we get nowhere. Whereas once you identify what those things are that are being communicated, you can say, okay, let's try getting to the interior cognition. Let's try maybe making some safe space for each other to respect the other person's experience and respect the other person's interior cognition. Then we get somewhere.
I resonate so deeply with everything that you're talking about. And I'm getting like flashbacks to, I'm just wrapping up my second emotional intelligence coaching program. And a lot of what we're talking about is what's underneath of what our expression is. Everything that you were saying of our thoughts and our emotions and our values or principles that really guide everything that we do, mm-hmm. It's not talked about. Except in containers and spaces like these. Right. And I'm curious, what are ways that maybe folks can start to have those conversations? And how this deeper level of awareness can remove, because where my mind's going with it is it allows the ability to remove bias from, yes, from the way we communicate, but also from our designs, from our solutions.
Yeah. Yeah. We can become much more intentional about supporting people that we've been ignoring, or that we've been accidentally making to feel unwelcome. And I think everybody's going to have their own way of going about this. This is a self-discovery kind of thing. But one of the things, one of the techniques is that I've heard a lot of people talking about is like, you know, you don't have to go out there and cause. You can invite and listen and internally start building a better understanding of someone. This is called relationship building. I find that a lot of people in the user experience field tend to complain about not being heard and not being able to persuade anyone. And the product owners have all the power and they get to make these stupid decisions and they don't know what they're doing, right? We're not building those relationships. Those relationships take work. And we don't have to like go to the product manager and say, hey, I'm going to build a relationship with you, damn it. But we can say, hey, I'd like to understand your thinking behind that. When you made that decision, kind of lead me through it. Okay. Yeah. I am open. I'm not judging you.
It's a curiosity that you mentioned earlier.
Yeah. And if you have already a toxic relationship with that person, they may not engage. They may not be willing to become vulnerable with you and tell you their inner thinking. They already have all these preconceived notions about the way your mind works. Mm-hmm. And based on your past behaviors and opinions and preferences. Mm-hmm. So it may not work in all cases, but there might be a way to reset the field and say, okay, I was wrong. I was wrong because I wasn't hearing you and I want to hear you now. And if you hear somebody enough and if they start feeling understood and if they're not like a total narcissist, which happens, they will start to hear you. It will start to become an exchange because they feel you supporting them. They feel you not judging them. They feel you asking questions to understand not their expression level, but their interior cognition, their inner thinking, their emotional reactions, and their guiding principles at certain points in the past as they were addressing a particular purpose.
Yeah, where my mind is going, and you alluded to this already, but for I just want to acknowledge that it takes a lot of courage to if you do have, we'll say, like a spicy relationship with a coworker. It takes a lot of courage to be that person who says something, because in so many ways it's so much easier to be like, okay, it's your fault.
Yeah, exactly. I think it does take courage. It can be the situation where you're like, I was wrong, you know, just to sort of like do some sort of reset. Or you could maybe set up situations where somebody else does some listening to that person. And maybe you hear from that somebody else, or you sit in and you listen to that. Generally, sitting in and listening doesn't work because listening deeply is a one-on-one situation. You need to make a safe space. And if a person is aware of another being listening in, that part of their cognition during that session is going to be aware of that other person and what that other person is thinking and how they're being judged. So possibly you can get another party to go and do some listening to that person. The idea in a listening session is that there are two modes to it. Most traditional interviews are that list of questions and you're in the present moment trying to help that interviewer get the answers that they need, right? As the participant or as the person being listened to. And so you're together in that moment. In a listening session, the emphasis is not on that moment. You will be in that moment together. I call it session mode, but the emphasis is on memory mode. The emphasis is on going back to a past point where some inner thinking happened, or a past point where a decision was made and a certain guiding principle was applied or totally ignored. I mean, we ignore our guiding principles all the time. Yeah. One person's all like, yeah, I'm teaching my daughters not to text while driving because I'm teaching them to drive. And then, you know, like 12 minutes later, she's talking about being late to a doctor's appointment and at a stoplight texting the doctor. Right? I mean, technically you're at the wheel. Yeah, you're at the stoplight, but you're going against your own guiding principle. We do that all the time. We're totally human. And we have conflicting emotions too. A lot of what goes on in a listening session is helping somebody, when they get into it, explain to you what their inner thinking was and what their emotional reactions were. And it gets all tangled up. Okay. It's even hard for them necessarily to parse them apart. You may be aware that they're tangled in session mode in the moment, and you may be able to ask questions about it to help untangle that or get clarity about it, or you may not be aware of it, in which case later when we're doing our synthesis, we're trying to untangle things. In the listening session itself, you're spending almost 100% of your attention paying, wrapped attention to that person. You're following where they go. You're noticing what the topics are. And a little part of the background process in your mind, there's two other things that you might be monitoring. One is, are they exterior level or are they at the interior cognition of that jawbreaker of that concept? If they're only at the exterior, I'm going to try to ask questions to encourage them to the interior cognition. If I'm aware of it, I might not be aware of it, and that's fine. Nobody's perfect. The other thing that you're paying attention to is, like, are we in session mode? We're spending too much time talking about to each other about this present moment, or are we going back into memory mode often enough?
I want to be mindful of our time. There's one question in the chat. So if folks have any other questions, we'll get to that, or I can ask Indy questions all night, but I'm not going to do that. So we have a question from Vinish. So mental models and our operating principles can be very individual, and so are different for different individuals. Sometimes it is challenging to show and present the synthesis of a team's mental models that makes sense of the collective view intelligence picture.
Yeah. I use opportunity maps to refer to the whole. The mental model is just the top city skyline of how I understand it. And the answer to that is that, yes, it's a team's understanding of how people think. And we need patterns to show up. And the only way we're going to get patterns to show up is to carefully craft what the purpose is that we're listening to everybody about. If we don't craft that well enough, we're going to get disparate stories. And those disparate stories are not patterns. And we don't get insights until those patterns show up and we align our current solutions with the different approaches and the different parts of the approaches that people are taking toward that purpose. We don't get insights until after we've done that and we start to see the gaps and we start to see, like, where we could do better. And we start to get excited about this opportunity and prioritize this other thing that we hadn't prioritized before. That's where the insights happen. The insights do not happen in synthesis. So that is the answer. When we're trying to get a team to understand the people that we're trying to support, we need a purpose that we agree on, that we're going to collect knowledge about. Without that, there's no way everybody's going to agree. The other thing is, if you're doing analysis on qualitative data each researcher is going to come up with their own interpretation of it. We're not doing analysis. We're doing synthesis, which is letting the people's words come up, their inner thinking, their emotional reaction, their guiding principles. Where was their focus of mental attention when they were back in that memory mode, thinking that or feeling that? And so we will combine based on focus of mental attention. And that's how this thing grows, where I've had the same set of data that I put in front of my participants in my courses year after year, coming up with basically the same patterns and also basically the same thinking styles. Hmm. So it's not analysis. It's true that analysis will, it's too focused on getting an immediate insight to me. Because I want to hear other perspectives. I don't want my insights. I don't want my perspective. I want theirs. And I'm not going to do anything about it or do any thinking about it or like derive any insights about it until I compare it to the solutions that we already have in place or that we're planning. And that's when I start going like, ah, look, we are supporting this thinking style in this little neighborhood, these sets of towers here. We're thinking, we're supporting this one thinking style and not the other one. Oops, there's an opportunity. Do we want to prioritize it? Maybe in a couple of years. But this other section where like we're falling down for all the thinking styles. And generally there's like two thinking styles, three, four that come out for a particular purpose. Mm-hmm. We're framing everything by the purpose. Maybe we're more interested in that. One of the things that happens with opportunity maps is that we then frame our usability studies. We even can frame our generative studies based on that purpose. And then we can layer that data back onto the opportunity map and start to see quarter by quarter how well we're supporting people and if we're improving our support for different thinking styles or if we're improving our support where we just fell down on the job entirely. So, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you so much. We have another question from Alan. Can you give another example of a purpose and then the thinking styles that come with that?
Yeah, purpose is difficult to understand when we're all used to thinking through the lens of our solution. So here's an example from the book that I have permission to use. Alexandra Jacoby she's a community manager. And one of the communities that she's trying to support is people who are, because of the pandemic, sort of like lacking in connection to people around things that they are experiencing uniquely. And it's a certain set of experiences that people are having. And I think, I don't know exactly what the set of experiences are, but I think it has to do with choice to have children or not to have children, that kind of an area. And she kept thinking that, you know, it's through conversation, this is going to happen. Conversation is going to help people do self-discovery. And I said, Alexandra, conversation is a solution. She's like, what? What's the purpose? The purpose that a person has in that scenario is to make that decision and to feel confident or comfortable with that decision or to feel supported in that decision. Maybe we use that last one as our purpose. How do I feel supported in that particular decision about to have children or not have children, given my certain circumstances, whether I'm partnered or not, right? And if that's the purpose, people are accomplishing that purpose with a variety of tools. They're talking to their friends, they're watching shows, they're listening to podcasts, they're thinking back to maybe something that a professor in college was talking about. there we've got social tools, there we've got memory tools, there maybe watching shows could be like a digital tool. I've got another example where there's manual tools and mechanical tools that show up as well. There are a lot of different tools. And if you think of that person with that purpose being in the center, they're like surrounded by this halo of things that they can reach for. Maybe part of what they reach for is meditation because it's a hard thing to think about. Or part of what they reach for is going on long trail runs. So those are solutions also. Conversation might be one of those solutions. And as soon as you realize that we're looking at it through the lens of conversation and we can let go of that and step back and think about what a person's purpose is, then we've got the frame to go and collect a broader set of data. Maybe there are people who are neurodiverse for whom the tool of conversation is not great, not a good match, right? How do we support them? That's an amazing opportunity. So the other example of a purpose that I use that I did in a study once was a company wanted to understand, they wanted to innovate in the kitchen. And I'm like, that's too broad. You know how many things you do in the, how many purposes you have in the kitchen. It took us 2 months, but we finally came to the conclusion that we're going to investigate how people cook dinner, but not just cook any old dinner, because you could just throw something in the microwave. Cook dinner when you think of yourself as a creative chef. And that gave us a structured enough purpose to go and do listening sessions. I think we had like 12 or 15 people and come up with some different thinking styles and hear different approaches. It was really interesting seeing what came out of that. That was some people are, as a creative chef, they see something that they're inspired by and want to make that thing happen. Whereas others are more inspired by their own like unique dietary needs or their children's unique dietary needs. Still others are really focused on perfecting something. There was a man who was perfecting mac and cheese, and he had kids, so they would eat mac and cheese, and he made like mac and cheese every week and tweaked things. So there's different thinking styles there. I just mentioned three of them that came up, but there's also different parts of the approach that then this organization like had it all laid out for them. It's like, wow, now we can see where there might be gaps that we can fill. Another example of a purpose was taking care of my clothing. Taking care of my clothing. That was a fairly broad purpose because it encompassed the moment. I didn't know this was going to happen. The moment that somebody's looking at something in the store and wondering, like, how am I supposed to care for this? Is it going to be too much, too hard for me? To the other end of the stream where they're like, I haven't worn this in 3 months. I'm going to put it in this other closet for another 6 months. And then it goes in the bag to go to be donated for 2 months. And then it actually gets donated. That was like one person's little process, right? But there, that focus of mental attention, like deciding whether I want to get rid of a piece of clothing is a part of caring for your clothing. I wouldn't have predicted that. Of course, all in the center is like getting rid of stains and figuring out how to stop the pilling on a sweater or like how I actually do laundry. So it has a lot of things in there. We could have changed that purpose and narrowed it down to just stains. How do you handle stains? And we could have actually expanded that to not be in clothing. And so how do you handle stains, period? Then we get stains that happen to curtains or carpets, not just clothing. And how do you handle it when it's something that you can't put into a washing machine?
Yeah. Well, thank you for providing a wide variety of examples. Yeah. And you're making me get a little nostalgic of like working with closely with a researcher and like diving in on a problem. And I'm getting a little sentimental. We're going to take two more questions from Jennifer and Estran, and then we'll wrap things up. So Jennifer asks, I'd love to hear more about how and why designers feel frustrated or undervalued and how they can change the paradigm in healthy ways that have long lasting effects.
I have not done any research as to why. I don't know why. I can't answer that question without doing a bunch of listening sessions. I can guess, but those would be my guesses. I hear a lot of stories about people being hired into teams whose leadership think that UX is something different than what the team members think it is. So that seems to be a theme. That UX is kind of like, okay, now that we have this idea, the solution that we've developed, you make it pretty, or you make it, you know, functional, or you put the words around it. So that's definitely a theme. I think that that's like at the broad level organizationally, but it's also at the narrow level, like between a person and their manager not understanding what can be done. And so within that theme, how is it that you rectify this lack of knowledge, this lack of understanding? And there, of course, are a variety of ways of doing it. I think developing relationships with these people, showing them how interested you are in understanding them is a first step. But there's also people who have gone and done, I've heard about this a lot, they've gone and done little bits of research or made like a sketchy version of an opportunity map with a mental model diagram, city skyline, and the current solutions aligned. And they use that. They've taken existing data. In a listening session, I talked about topics, right? And I talked about the different concepts, and the concepts can be at exterior or interior. The interior concepts that I pull out of a typical transcript, I get between 40 and 120. If I go and use old interview transcripts, I'll get 4 or 10, but there's still 4 or 10, and you can still use those if you want to pull things. So I've heard that story a lot of times. I've heard stories where people are pulled in like to an emergency situation, and they know how to do this correctly. They have done it for a lot of other people, but it's an emergency situation. There's not a lot of time. And so that's what they do. They go grab the existing data. They pull the little interior inner thinking, emotional reactions, guiding principles, pull that, do the synthesis, make a diagram, an opportunity map, so that then they can work with that. The whole point is getting to that level so that you can start doing your insights and your work and your prioritization and your enthusing people about looking at a person's world from their perspective. One of the other things that has fallen out of that is even with the little ones that people put together in an emergency, it is so that the other teams, like the software architecture, the content editors, the designers, the developers, they'll see things from the same way. The product managers will start to see things from the same viewpoint. And if we're starting to then do our usability testing based on that same purpose, we can map it, layer it on to the opportunity map. And we're all seeing the thing the same way. And that has actually been a lot of the success stories that I've been hearing from people. So I don't know if that helps answer.
It's a starting point, at least.
Yeah.
So we have one more question from S. Chen. So what makes for a more beautiful frame or a more beautiful question?
I'm not sure I understand that question. beautiful. So the word frame I use to mean scope, and the scopes that work are ones that have more of a chance of creating patterns. And so that's why I frame things by purpose. And I talked about that already. The word question is in there. And I'm like, okay, I actually don't ask any questions in a listening session. Oftentimes, I'm just following what a person is saying, and I'm trying to encourage them to speak at depth at that interior cognition level. I generally don't ask it as a question with an uptick at the end. But there are several techniques that I use. One is called micro-reflection. It's not the kind of reflection where people think that you're just supposed to restate something that somebody said back to them to show them that you understood or to check that you understood. It's a micro-reflection to encourage them to say more about it. You might choose a couple of words that they just said and say them, and the person continues. You're trying to keep them rolling and not interrupt. But at the same time, you're also noticing maybe they're not down at the interior cognition level. And so you'll say a couple of words, micro-reflecting. People do bigger reflections as well. Some people can even do complex reflections, continuing the paragraph. But that takes a bit more of a cognition away from paying attention to people. There's another thing where I kind of like open the field. I'll say, you know, they'll say something and I'll say, because, and then they'll start into their interior cognition, or they might go into an explanation and then we'll get into the interior cognition. I rarely say the word why, but why stands in for the word because, but I hardly ever inflect it up at the end because I'm trying to get them to just, you know, keep rolling. So there's a couple of other techniques that are also in the book. That involves trying other ways of getting back to the interior cognition.
Well, I think it's a good push for folks when the book comes out pretty soon to go check out the book. So I'm going to shift to thanks for folks who have stayed on a bit over time. We're going to shift to a couple of closing questions. So we've dabbled on a wide variety of topics today, all under the umbrella of listening, but sprinkled in with psychological safety and curiosity and mindsets and values and principles, and many other things in between. And all of these fall under the umbrella also of emotional intelligence. And so I'm curious, from your perspective, why is this an important skill set for designers, researchers, UXers to invest in?
There's so many answers to that question. We could go on for another hour. How do I answer it quickly? One of the things that when you're developing safe space is you're also paying attention to developing a safe space for yourself. That all of this means you're paying more attention to what's being said and how it's affecting the other person and how it's affecting yourself. In the book, I talk about, and I actually have an essay on my Medium site about like what happens if you get into territory that's triggering you. How do you end that? There's a certain threshold that I set up for people, and I'm like, don't cross that threshold unless you're absolutely certain you want to cross that threshold. And in general, don't cross that threshold. You're going to hurt yourself. So it's self-awareness. The other thing is that if you're trying to channel somebody else and actually get their interior cognition, you have to be aware of your own interior cognition and be able to dial it down a little bit. One of the things that I talk about with beginner's mind is that it's being able to recognize that we have carried into this session our own past. And we need to be able to sort of turn that off and focus only on the other person's and the other person's past. However, our own past is valid and our own past is respectable. And so knowing what it is and sort of dwelling on it and becoming more familiar with it is something that helps us be able to tune it down. You can't just turn it off if it's out there sort of, you know, harassing you in your own mind. I can't think of the right word, but, you know, we all self-doubt. We're like, oh my God, what a stupid question. I'm like, let's not let that enter into our cognition when we're in a listening session. Yeah, okay, so I asked a leading question, whatever, I'm just going to let it go. Get back on track, off we go, paying attention to the other person. So it's, I think it's very helpful with respect to being able to develop relationships at work and in your career. One of the things that I tell people is that if we are going to actually do something about helping others understand what user experience is about, we have to be able to not only understand where they came from, but feel confident in where we're coming from. Right? And if it's just a whole mess of like us feeling disrespected, we have to acknowledge that we're feeling disrespected. How are we feeling disrespected? Who can we talk about or talk to about who can listen to us so that we feel heard? And that's kind of what you're doing, Rachel.
Yeah, very, very, very much so. And there's so many things that that you are alluding to in that answer that we could talk for much longer about. But one wrap-up question for folks: if you could ask one thing of the folks listening in relation to anything that we spoke of today, so one thing that they can get started on once they hop on this call or once they take out their headphones. After listening to this, once it's released, what would it be?
Oh, so this is an ask of the people listening. Okay,
exactly.
So everybody, you are my friends. We are in this together. I think I'm teaching a bunch of techniques. One thing that you could do is start to just recognize when you're hearing things at the interior versus the exterior. But another thing is to recognize that you don't have to do it my way. You might have another way of doing it that I just haven't run across yet. So that's kind of a dual ask, but it's really interesting.
Yeah. I love it. Well, folks, if you put any of those, both asks into practice, be sure to tag at Indy Young on Twitter at @design_to_be. And we'd love to hear, how it's going. But thank you so much, Indy, for your time and your energy. I love your enthusiasm with all things research and mindset. It made me so excited. So I really appreciate your time today. And thank you for everyone listening and asking questions and your presence today. I so appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you, everybody, for being here. And thank you for being yourselves and for, you know, recognizing yourselves and taking this and putting it into position in your own world the way you would do it.
That wraps up another episode of Design to Be Conversation. Thanks so much for listening. If you're curious for more ways to invest in your EQ to be a more empowered, educated, and effective designer, head over to designtobe.com. That is designtobe.com. You can take our design process EQ quiz or sign up for our newsletter to receive the latest Design to Be community building, live offerings, and self-inquiry guidance directly to your inbox. If you enjoyed this episode, we invite you to leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you may listen. Be sure to share this podcast with a fellow designer who's interested in investing in their EQ. And again, thanks so much for listening.